Okay. Ooh. It's reminded of that. No, it makes me think of when I was set apart as a pastor last century. It's a bit sad when you look at it that way, isn't it? It's 1993. And no, I don't want to know how old Olivia was then, because she wasn't. That's right. Respect your elders. A real privilege to be able to talk about the Gospel of John. And a couple of things I want to address first. One, I'm being absolutely blown away as we read through the Gospel of John, how much new stuff I am getting out of it. Now, I couldn't tell you the number of times I've read through the Gospel of John, but I'm seeing stuff that I have never seen before. And whether that's because I've grown, the possibility of that happens even when you're old. Whether it's because we're fasting at the same time, I don't know. It's just there are dots that I can see that I join up, which is normally something I just do instinctively, that I haven't seen before. So I'll share some of those dot joining with you. I also want to follow up on the comment that Caleb made about me fasting alcohol. I'm fasting alcohol not because I have a problem with it, even though my son owns a whiskey bar. Bit of a pattern, family pattern there. But anyway, I'm fasting it because it's what God told me to do. What he didn't give me time to do was to stop and think about the timing. Because we've got the cricket club presentation night before Easter that's being held in a pub. I have my sister and brother-in-law's joint 70th birthday and 50th wedding anniversary celebration before Easter being held in a pub. And God's gone, here you go, fast alcohol. I've gone, great. Cricket yesterday. Back there, I got asked the question, so have you had your Coopers yet, Andrew? I've gone, no, not drinking till Easter. What? It just, no, fasting for Lent. What's Lent? I could have made a lot of jokes, but I just played a straight bat at it. Appreciate the pun there. And just explained it. Had a fascinating talk with a guy afterwards, one of the new players at our club, who was telling me about his experience with Christian churches and everything else while he was in rehab. Gone, cool. And he visited a lot of churches, and it opened up a conversation that I wouldn't have been able to have with him otherwise. So I sit there and go, there you go. At work, I work in a very multicultural environment. And a lot of the people I work with are Muslim. A lot of the people I play cricket with are Muslim. Trying to captain a team of players where 10 of them are fasting creates some challenges. And I don't know how much you're familiar with the Islamic fast, but from sunrise to sunset, they can't even drink water. So playing cricket on a 31-degree day creates some challenges. So we managed that, we navigated that, and were able to pull the pin a bit early. But had some conversations at work. Piece of trivia for you. Most Muslims during Ramadan, when they're fasting, put on weight. Why? Because they break fast after sunset and put on a feast. And it's interesting, both the people that I was having conversations with during the week have asked the question going, I really just don't think that's what fasting's about. So we actually had a interfaith discussion about fasting and what the purpose of fasting was and how the whole point of fasting is to sharpen you and bring you closer to God. So I'm thinking, okay, God, this is just going somewhere. We'll just see how this pans out over the next 40 days. I'm really looking forward to it. One of the guys that I work with quite a lot, his last comment was, about fasting. I've mentioned Isaiah 58, but didn't give it a title. And he then sent me a message going, so what was that reference? So I sent it through to him. So there you go, I've got him reading the Bible. Little by little. No, we don't have to hit him over the head and change him in one instance. Little by little. So let's get on. Abide. Ooh, where are we? No, what have I done wrong? No. Oh, here we go. John's Gospel. So Caleb put this slide up last week. John doesn't include any parables in his Gospel. Personally, I think that the signs that he includes, the miracles that he includes, perform the function that the parables do in the other three Gospels. So a parable, for those of you that aren't familiar, is a story that Jesus used drawing on common everyday events. You look at the parables, the vast majority of them are either about agriculture or money. So a parable draws on that, but underneath is a deeper spiritual truth. And it's a mechanism that Jesus used. For those that were seeking him, they got the spiritual truth. For those that were rejecting him, they go, he talks nonsense, we don't. And so it actually helped separate those that were following and seeking and those that weren't. The miracles do exactly the same thing. John describes them as signs pointing so that you may believe that Jesus is a Messiah. People would look at those miracles and go, meh. Yeah, so he did something. So I think there's that aspect in John's Gospel where we need to look, what's the deeper spiritual truth that John is highlighting in that miracle that he's described? And we'll explore that a little bit in my message today. Now, the 40 days of Lent, Caleb's already spoken about that, so move on from there. Anybody tell me what that's a picture of? Anyone? It's Woodstock. 3 days of love, peace, and music. Interestingly, it went for more than 3 days. They ran out of everything, including time. The headline act of Woodstock played when half the people had gone home because they ran over time. They ran out of food, they ran out of water, they ran out of toilets, ran out of everything. Why? Because they were planning for about 200,000 people and had 500,000. Way more successful. Gridlocked the whole of that area of New York State. No. Interestingly, the whole event lost money. Bit of trivia for you there. But they ran out. I've experienced it, not on that scale. Saturday before, well, a couple of Saturdays ago, I was captaining our second 11 down at Sky Reserve down the road here. It was a warmish day. And I've gone to the guy who looks after the canteen. I've gone, how are we off for cordial? He's done a bit of a hunt. We've got half a bottle. Three drinks breaks. So drinks break, afternoon tea, and the second, another drinks break. It's like half a bottle of cordial's not going to cut it. We'd run out. So Fortunately, one of our batsmen went out cheaply, and he was a guy that I trusted, so we gave him the club credit card, said, can you just nick down to Coles and grab us some more cordial? We were able to fix the problem relatively easily. Running it, I mean, as captain, no, the pressure was on. No, you, anybody played cricket? Or it's just me? A few of you, yeah. Yeah. You get the cordial wrong, that's it. You have lost all credibility as a captain. Doesn't matter what you do during the game, tactically or anything else. If the cordial's rubbish, you're rubbish. Simple as that. It was just a challenge I wasn't prepared to, no. It was like, no, I've got to get this right. Make it right. So fixed it. And no, Matty came through to the rescue. Businesses, heap of stories of businesses where they have expanded too quickly and got themselves into financial trouble. When things go better than you expect, you can create problems. Growth can often be self-defeating. Success can lead to problems of running out. So running out at an inconvenient time, regardless of the reason, is pain. In some cultures, it's more than a pain, it's just totally unacceptable. Anybody here watched the series The Chosen? Yeah, great, really interesting series to have a look at and everything else. And they did a whole episode on the incident that I'm going to be talking about today, which is the marriage feast at Cana. If you haven't worked that out, if you've been doing the reading, you would have read John chapter 2, and you would have known they ran out of wine. And I think one of the things that the episode in The Chosen about it really brings out well is just how socially unacceptable that was for a host to run out of wine. It was just like, just not on, you know. They put an interesting spin on it in the program, but that embarrassment just wasn't an option for the host. Running out that last drop. So let's have a read through it. The next day, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities, so Jesus' mother told him, "They have no more wine." Jesus' response, "Dear woman, that's not our problem." Jesus replied, "My time has not yet come." But his mother told the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." So, interesting little dynamic between Jesus and his mum there. Now, well, I want to point out the word "dear," the phrase "dear woman" there in the Aramaic doesn't imply any disrespect at all. It's not a "stupid woman, shut up." It was a "mum, not my problem. Not my circus, not my monkeys." Standing nearby were 6 stone water jars used for Jewish ceremonial washing. They could go into a bit of, in The Chosen, they go into a little bit of an explanation as to why it was significant that they were stone jars. Interesting. I encourage you to watch it. Each could hold 20 to 30 gallons. This did my head in. 20 to 30 gallons. They're a big jar. That's US gallons too, by the way, because the New Living Translation is an American translation, so a US gallon apparently is different to an Australian gallon. Who knew? I found that out while I was researching this. If you want that converted into litres, it's about 80 to 120 litres each. It's a big jar. So Jesus told the servants, having said, "Not my problem," Jesus told the servants, "Fill the jars with water." Now, it's not like they could grab a hose and fill the jars. They had to get water from somewhere where it was being stored, carry it and tip it into the water. This was not a 3-minute job. This was not something they could do quickly. Think about it, do the maths. 6 jars, 80 to 120. That's somewhere between 480 and 720 litres of water that needed to be put into those jars. That's a reasonable task. Not something you're going to do quickly. And the host is stalling. So that process takes. I really feel for the servants in this whole story, because they would have been like, this guy is setting us up to make us look like absolute idiots. He's getting us to do work that makes no sense at all. And then he's telling us to do something that has the potential to be incredibly embarrassing. Because Jesus goes on, when the jars had been filled, he said, now dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies. We've just put water. We know where the water came from. We know we put it into the jar. And now we're going to go and take some to the master of ceremonies. Great. So you want me to go and give the master of ceremonies some water. Thanks for that. The way servants got treated when they messed up wasn't always particularly positive. So the servants followed his instructions. Important to note that. They did it anyway. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course the servants knew, he called the bridegroom over. A host always serves the best wine first, he said. Then when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine. Now, you serve the good stuff first, and then when everybody can no longer worry about what it tastes like, that's when you serve the rubbish. Standard practice. Still standard practice. But you have kept the best until last, until now. This miraculous sign in Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory. This was his first public miracle. And his disciples believed in him. Say what? They're his disciples. They're following it. They've laid down their nets. They're following him. And it took him turning water into wine for them to believe him. Believe in him. Let that sink in. No, there's a level of belief that enables you to follow. But there's another level of belief where you believe in Jesus. Following's one thing, believing in. Now, Kyle, fabulous job with the worship. What was his focus? Trusting God. Believing in Jesus is about trusting him. It's about allowing him to do what he needs to do, despite the circumstances we might be going through at the time. Trusting in him that he is good and he has our best interests at heart. If we can do that, that's it. But it takes a lot for people to get to that level of belief. After the wedding, he went to Capernaum or Capernaum, depending on where you studied, for a few days with his mother, his brothers, and his disciples. Bit of a, okay, I need a break in the local big city. We're going to the city for a rest. And that's the end of that account. So, I mentioned before, I believe that John uses the mechanism of describing the signs and miracles in his gospel the same way as parables. So there's a deeper spiritual meaning in this miracle that John's described. And what is it? Jesus has demonstrated his power. By turning water into wine, Jesus demonstrated his power over the nature of nature. He can take water and turn it into something that's not water. I had a science teacher when I was in secondary school, a long time ago, that said he could do the reverse. He could turn wine into water. It's boiled off that and just, you know, condensed the... It's like, yeah, that's good. That's a reverse miracle, and that doesn't really require a whole lot. He's a bit of a smart aleck. Jesus, and this is one of the things that sort of hit me as we've been studying John, the number of times that what John is describing refers back to the creation accounts in Genesis. Caleb mentioned this last week. Now, John's gospel starts off with the words "in the beginning," just like Genesis chapter 1. Here, Jesus turns water into wine. What did God do in Genesis chapter 2? He turned dirt into man, turned one thing into something else. I want to have a look at another of the miraculous signs that John highlights. This is in John chapter 4. So again, you should have known, this was yesterday. As he travelled through Galilee, he came to Cana, where he had turned water into wine. So John's a little bit worried that, hey, people are going to forget where Cana was and what happened in Cana, because it was two chapters ago. But turning the water into wine, John's going, this is important. I'm going to just remind you, this is what happened in Cana. There was a government official in nearby Capernaum, where he went and visited afterwards, whose son was very sick. When he heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went and begged Jesus to come to Capernaum to heal his son, who was about to die. Had a bit of a pressing need, a family need that needed to be addressed. Jesus asked, "Will you never believe in me unless you see miraculous signs and wonders?" Other translations for that verse translate that as, "Will you people never believe?" The "you" that's there is plural. Will you people never believe in me unless you see the miraculous signs and wonders? Because for the Jews, that's what they needed to know that Jesus was the Messiah. They needed to see that he was doing signs and wonders, that he was doing things that the other prophets hadn't done. The official pleaded, "Lord, please come now before my little boy dies." Then Jesus told him, "Go back home, your son will live." That's all he did. No, half a dozen words, seven words. And the man believed what Jesus said and started home. Didn't take the miracle, took the word. Different person, different mechanism leading to belief. While the man was on his way home, some of his servants met him with news that his son was alive and well. He asked them when the boy had begun to get better, and they replied, "Yesterday afternoon at 1 o'clock, his fever suddenly disappeared." Then the father realized that this was the very time Jesus had told him, "Your son will live." And he and his entire household believed in Jesus. Again, it was the miracle mechanism leading to belief. This was the second miraculous sign Jesus did in Galilee after coming from Judea. By healing the official's son, what did Jesus demonstrate? The power he demonstrated there was the power over distance? No. Did he say, I'm God? Or did just he demonstrate that distance has no power over him? He is, to use the technical term, omnipresent. He didn't need to be there and lay hands on the Son. He could speak the word and something happened. For those of you familiar with Genesis, sound familiar? God spoke the word and things were created. Jesus spoke the word, healing happened. You see how it all, this is the thing that's blowing me away. It's like, wow, it all just, no. It's John using Jesus to retell the Genesis story. The people in Galilee needed signs to believe. We read in John chapter 4, so earlier in chapter John in verses 39 to 41, the people in Samaria, like the official, just needed to hear the word. No, Jesus with the woman at the well. They didn't need a sign. What they heard, the truth that they heard, was enough for them to believe in Jesus. I want to highlight here, the way to belief is not the same for every person. What brings one person to belief is not going to bring necessarily bring other people to belief. So having a cookie cutter approach of this is how we do reaching others is not going to work. You'll have some success, but if you want to reach people with the good news of the gospel, you need to understand what it is that's going to motivate them to belief. If you don't have that relationship with Christ, if you're here now and you're on that journey of discovering faith, ask yourself that question. What would it take for me to believe? What do I need God to do in my life for me to believe in him? That's going to be a different thing for every person. We live in a cynical, skeptical, rational society that's short on faith, hope, and love. You know, Caleb's mentioned multiple times, you know, the census results for the Langwarrin and Cranbourne South local government areas in the last census, the most nuns, and that doesn't mean people who are women in a religious order. It's the people who marked none on the question in the last census about their spiritual beliefs. They have none. 54%, I think it is, of nuns. So more people have nothing than those who have something, regardless of what that something is. So for the people of Frankston and Casey, if we do signs and wonders, we do miracles, it might just make them think, but it's unlikely to bring them to belief. But if we can show them the power of a transformed life, a life full of love, faith, and hope, if we can explain, as it says in 1 Peter, to have a reason for the hope that is within us, if we can do that, we're more likely to be able to bring them to a place of belief and shine our light in the dark places that are there. So I reckon there is five, I like doing lists, five reasons to believe. Signs, wonders, and miracles. Yep, they will bring some people to belief. The Jews, that was the mechanism that was appropriate for Jesus to use for them. Words of truth, like the Samaritans, like the word that was spoken to the official, enabled them to believe. An encounter with Christ, like the disciples, the calling of the disciples in John chapter 1, like the account of Paul's conversion in Acts chapter 9, all of those. Thank you. Right, encounter with Christ, personal needs met, like the official's family, like the recipients of the miracles, all of those had a personal need met and believed in Jesus. And then the fifth one I've added in, or the fourth one, is transformed lives. When lives are transformed, like us with our friends, our family, our work colleagues. Yeah. So, if you can change it, Matt. Thank you. What are the people you need to see to be able to believe? Jesus himself demonstrated transformation, describes himself as being the living water in John chapter 4. He goes through. And then in John... in John chapter 15, so we'll read this a little bit later in the month, Jesus describes himself as the true grapevine. So he was water, now he's a grapevine. And my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch of mine that doesn't produce fruit, and he prunes the branches that do bear fruit so that they will produce even more. You've already been pruned and purified by the message I have given you. So the words of truth. Remain in me. Or in some translations, abide, hence the title of our message, abide. For a branch cannot produce fruit if it is severed from the vine, and you cannot be fruitful unless you remain in me. Yes, I am the vine, you are the branches. Those who remain in me and I in them will produce much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. So we abide in the vine. What do vines produce? They produce grapes. What do grapes produce? Wine. And here we are back at the wine again. Really does make me sound like I've got an issue, doesn't it? Jesus is giving his disciples, his close followers, the invitation to be transformed. Caleb had us praying that prayer of transformation earlier. We've got this invitation to be transformed. Thanks, Matt. What part of your nature does Jesus need to transform? Don't care where you are in your journey with Christ. God can change you. He can turn water into wine. He can turn dirt into a man. He can turn me into somebody who actually cares. No, those people who've known me for a long time. No, God never stops working on you. I was a very, very detached individual for a long period of time. God did some work on me a couple of years ago, stuffed me up for work. I used to be able to do performance management really easily, because I could remain detached. Now I actually care about the person. Breaks my heart when I'm having conversations with people now. I'm in an area where it's like I'm dealing with trauma regularly, and it's like, oh, I've had this issue at work with a lady I'm working with, and it's like, oh, God, no. I want to rearrange my work from home days so that I'm not there the days that she's there. And there was a discussion one of the days I wasn't there, and she said some stuff that was fed back to me. I was going, All of a sudden, it's like I'm not annoyed at her anymore. I have this enormous compassion for her. And will take the way that I was interacting with her and change. Go, I can do this different. I can interact with her differently. For those of you that are in similar sort of field, I'll adopt a trauma-informed approach. Because that's what's going to be appropriate. That's how I'm going to be light to her. There's clearly been some darkness that's happened. So what part of your nature does Jesus need to transform? No? The communion that we're about to take. Again, interesting. Jesus, the living water, at the communion, at the last supper says, "This is my blood." So the living water got transformed into wine. Just like the miracle at Cana, water into wine. Living water, the wine that signifies what? This is my death. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians, do this, drink this cup in remembrance of me until I return. That's why we take communion. We take the broken biscuit, recognize the sacrifice that he made with his body being broken. So that we can have healing, so that we can have life. His blood being shed so that we can be washed clean. Again, washing, water. The imagery that is there is really, really consistent. But let us, if we can stand up. And while we're taking communion, I'd like each one of us to think, God, this is the area that I need to be transformed. Again, pray that transformation prayer.